Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce our first sponsorship with Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. Franklin D. Roosevelt once wrote, "Real estate cannot be lost or stolen, nor can it be carried away. Purchased with common sense and managed with reasonable care, it's about the safest investment in the world." So it's a good time to discuss the topic of real estate, but it's more than a topic. It's central to many of us, whether it's your own home, commercial property, farms and estates, whether it's to live in or to invest in, whether it's in the UK or around the world, property dominates conversations, probably second only to weather, at least here in the UK. So today I'm thrilled to have someone who sits at the epicenter of the world of real estate, Mark Ridley, the Group Chief Executive of Savills. Mark, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much, Simon. Delighted to be here.
Well, before we dissect these components, Mark, we're on a Zoom call. Everybody's had too many Zoom calls. Have you had any disasters?
One, I put it down to family enthusiasm. I was doing an update for actually the Financial Times with a number of their readers online. And as I was halfway through the interview, my wife came into, I was working from my home office because it was still very much lockdown time. And she looked at me, stared at the screen next to my head, and then said to me, "Where's the masking tape?" Anyway, need to say quite what the audience thought the masking tape was for, who knows. But yeah, I did explain to her rather quickly that I was talking to a number of people and it would be ideal if she found the masking tape herself. So yeah, I had a lot of comments back, as you can imagine, lots of texts about it. So there we go. I love working at home.
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, I can see you're in the West End and I'm in the West End, so we're at work. Well, let's just start at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your upbringing. Where did it happen and what do you particularly remember about it?
Okay, well, certainly nothing to do with property, I need to say. I was brought up in Cheshire. I still regard Cheshire as home for me, but even though I spend most of my time either in London or other international locations. But yeah, home is there still. My father was an engineer, much brighter than me. My mother, a doctor. So real estate sort of loomed because I thought actually it was interesting and I didn't think I was going to be a doctor. I've thoroughly enjoyed my career. I realized very quickly that my ability to be a professional sportsman was limited as well. So real estate, good opportunity, great people and great fun. So yeah, I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. I recommend it to everybody.
You obviously have been terrifically successful. Savills has 650 offices and 39,000 staff. But how did you actually get into the real estate business?
I started the usual way, perhaps going through university, doing a real estate degree. So quite traditional compared with many this time around and in the current climate. Thereafter, did my apprenticeship. And a bit like, I always like to have a bit of challenge. So having sort of qualified as a chartered surveyor, I decided it was time to go and do something completely different. I went abroad and I actually was seconded out to Sydney, Australia and worked out there. I had a fantastic time, learned to surf and learned a bit about real estate. That opened my eyes that actually international real estate and all the sort of elements of change in different markets was something I wanted to continue with. After that, you know, I came back to the UK, worked back in London, and then I joined Savills to actually open its first commercial office outside London all those years ago, about 25 years ago now. Me opening an office first time round, I knew nothing about what I was doing and neither did Savills. So it was an ideal partnership and it worked. And then I was asked to grow other offices. And over time, my role expanded. if I have one skill, I think it's selecting really good people around me, good teamwork. I've been very lucky to meet and work with some really impressive people. Over that period, I ended up running UK and European business. And then ultimately, when I pushed my old boss aside, as you have to these days, now, when he retired gracefully, I took over the group chief executive's role some 2 years ago now. I think every time I've taken on a new role, you should watch out because, of course, the markets change with Brexit and obviously a pandemic.
Right. Well, I suppose unlike most of your competitors, Savills has got a strong link to the agricultural sector as well as to the residential and commercial, which gives you a bird's eye view of the real estate trends. And we'll come back a little bit to Savills later on. But I'd like to start with residential property. In 1935, the board game Monopoly was bought by Parker Brothers. And since then, I learned the game's been played by over 1 billion people in 114 countries. And I didn't know until I researched for this podcast that British prisoners of war were sent Monopoly sets by humanitarian groups helped by the UK government, which had hidden in them maps, compasses, real money, and other objects that were useful for escaping. So I guess that was a variation of get out of jail free. But it's testament to the property's universal appeal and how it forms part of our aspirations and intrigues. So here in the UK, house prices have been rising since COVID quite sharply in places. Tell us, what's going on?
Well, very good question, Simon. I, for one, maybe we should have guessed this might happen. We saw, actually, as markets unlocked across China, where we have quite a big operation, we saw continued strength in residential markets there. And as then markets started to unlock moving east to west, a lot of commentators thought it might firstly be just the pent-up demand, i.e. people have been, you know, not being able to transact. So that period of unlock is going to improve trading for a period and then sort of fizzle out. Actually, we didn't see that. What we've seen is that continued demand and in many cases increasing. I suppose the question is why? What's driving this pickup? It is behavioral change in many markets. People have taken the view that being locked down potentially, but also seeing the benefits of better home working, maybe slightly longer commute, slightly better space, desires to have more space available. And that can be indoor space or it can be amenity space outside. That's been a common theme across all the markets, including the UK. And that's why we're seeing this resurgence of activity. People might have put off that move for a couple of years, but they've decided now, you know what? I'm going to make the jump and go and do it. The biggest change we've seen is the interest in country markets. And you've got to remember, some of those country markets hadn't perhaps even reached their pre-global financial crisis high in terms of value. So it's taken that long to come back. But some of those markets now are definitely enjoying their sort of day in the sun. And that's really good to see. And applicants, we monitor our applicants. And we're seeing about 2-1, and they're very high volumes, but 2-1 towards the country. So the country is definitely having, say, its best run. But also, London is not at all dead. It's not about this hollowing out of a donut, which then leaves us with nothing in London. Not true. I think it's the same point, which is people are looking at upgrading, they're taking on more space, having more amenity space as well. So even the sort of central London SW postcodes are continuing to improve. The only bit that's missing is the absolute prime. And in some cases, that's because people aren't traveling internationally. But that will come back once people are able to travel without quarantine. Overall, it's been really strong. And I think a lot of it is behavioral change, which I would hope is more sustainable than the pent-up demand equation that some people have talked about.
You got some quite positive, some would say punchy forecasts for the north of England as well that has been suffering perhaps disproportionately in all of this. And same forces driving that?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, don't forget, I come from the north, so I've made sure that the research supports that. No, but look, I think it is the same. It's affordability. Also, a number of the regional cities have got quite a lot going for them. So as much as London has got its place in the world order, many of the university cities are doing well, whether it's life sciences, science and technology. Some of the regional cities are benefiting from that, as well as the affordability argument. Those markets are responding to that. And I saw also the celebrity game show around Wales. Wales is now suddenly improving as well. I think different factors at play, but most definitely the North, the Midlands, parts of Scotland and Wales are continuing to improve and values are increasing.
I mean, we had this temporary stamp duty holiday, which I guess has given tax savings potentially of up to 15,000, and that must have helped. But two questions. One, that original George Osborne-led stamp duty hike, was that just an act of economic, how should I say this politely, misguidedness in terms of freezing the market?
Was it deliberate sabotage? I wouldn't say that. I think it was difficult to start. You know, the property ladder has to perform on every rung. If you really create a hurdle then, or a gap, take a rung out in some cases, that stops the functionality. That's what happened with what was regarded then as a penal stamp duty rate. And it slowed down a segment of the market significantly. As is always the case, the market reacts, the market reprices, and it eventually gets absorbed. But it definitely, for a number of years, actually slowed down transactions in that particular threshold level. And I think here, with the sort of stamp duty exemption till March, it's affecting a specific value part of the market. But it does help. It helps the functionality of the lower rungs as you move forward. We will see activity before the deadline expires in March. But I don't think it's just that. I think there's so many other factors, Simon, at play here. That obviously helps to a degree and certainly helps in some price points.
So it's interesting. You mentioned that having seen this first in China, then in the UK, when you look at your other geographies, is it mirrored similarly or are these in some way unusual?
No, it's probably because we have the greatest exposure to those in residential terms. But in terms of other markets, no, we've seen that resurgence coming across almost as the markets came out of lockdown. You know, one area that picked up probably the quickest was the residential markets. So we've seen the consumer in residential or in, you know, other terms is actually not in hibernation. And as soon as it's allowed back or she's allowed back into the markets do respond. That is a common theme. And there's the same common theme about more space, you know, more space for the family, more space for the individual.
So let's talk about where there's lots of space, UK retail. So the UK has the most advanced e-commerce market in Europe as measured by penetration rates. And pre-COVID, retail was already dealing with changing shopping habits. But obviously, COVID has accelerated those trends. And the wealth destruction, for example, in shopping centres has been enormous. I'm told that the St. Nicholas Shopping Centre in Maidenhead, once traded for £85 million, just been sold for £25 million. Same time, we've got a shortage of housing in the UK. So this beginning of a conversation about, I guess, what's called repurposing, but a regeneration of shopping centres to provide a mix of housing and smaller retail, is that going to happen?
It is happening. It's never straightforward, these things. But, you know, we have seen, I suppose, the acceleration of e-tailing in the UK, where we were around, but pre-pandemic, we were around 20% of all retail shopping was online. Last stat I saw was 27%. That compares against probably the highest e-tail penetration is China at around 30%. We are ahead of Europe by a long way in terms of e-tail penetration, and we have been sort of quite multi-channel. Sadly, it is at the demise of some of the traditional bricks and mortar retail, and we've seen that occurring, rents falling. We do have in the UK, quite a dense amount of retail space in different forms, whether it's high street, out-of-town retail or retail parks, through to fashion parks and shopping centres. It's probably the shopping centre market that's been the most adversely affected. Why? Combination of high rents, high service charges to occupy those spaces. So they've been rebalancing. The pandemic itself doesn't help. The idea of being an enclosed space as opposed to being outside where you can have ease of car parking. So what we have seen is the out-of-town retail actually picking back up as a segment. We've seen some of the local high streets be quite positive improvements through local shopping habits as people shop definitely more locally and more conveniently. Your point is well made. There is going to be a repurposing of some of this retail. It has to be. Where it's close to town centres in areas that could see a regeneration, residential is certainly something that can be considered there, subject to planning and all the other constraints on that. The other side to it is other forms of use, whether it be as and when we're able to, leisure and hospitality. Those areas can come back. They're not going to come back anytime soon, but they will come back. And we've also seen the inevitable rise of logistics because of that e-tail. Some of the big box retail does suit logistics. It's not dissimilar in its functionality. So we're seeing, particularly in the southeast of England, where rents on logistics are getting very high, we're seeing some conversion of some retail warehousing back into logistics. You'll see different ways that the excess retail space is going to be reabsorbed into the market. I, for one, am not a doom monger about the end of retail. I also wonder what life will be like when we've gone through a pandemic. How much has been accelerated by the pandemic? How much will settle back? And where the consumer habits will change again? So a lot of challenge in the sector there.
But, you know, the UK's got an estimated shortfall of 90,000 houses at least, and successive governments have failed to grasp the nettle and to really get on with it. So this presumably could go some way to dealing with that shortfall. And what else, other than that, do you think needs to be done?
Answering the question in the same order, I would say, yes, it could. I wouldn't say it's a panacea for all our problems, but certainly I could see some of that excess land, car parking, be used for residential purposes. The winners of this pandemic war, if you like, definitely has been built to rent, or in the US it's called multifamily, is something that has taken a real step forward. The investors, most definitely, world investors, all want to have exposure to it for its defensive qualities. What we're seeing in the UK, as an example, that has started to grow, whether it be student housing, whether it be built to rent, and we're starting to see portfolios created. The demand from investors far outstrips supply. There is demand from the occupational side, people wanting to occupy the right sort of residential accommodation. And we've got to make sure that what's available is right, whether it's the right price point or it's providing the right type of accommodation. And building one-bedroom units or two-bedroom units doesn't necessarily solve the problem. So you're going to have a lot more variation in the models, the opportunities to create that, whether it be apartments, whether it be houses, different functionality coming forward. We're going to see a prevalence of that going forward from the investors, investors driving that ability to build and build speculatively. So I think overall, it does look good. We will start to address it. If the public sector, Simon, can also provide extra land, unlock its public sector land to a greater degree, that will also help. Because as much as we do have land, it's a small island, and we've got to make sure we use the space that we can, you know, most effectively.
So let's talk about commercial properties, specifically office buildings. Lots of conversations about work practices changing and big implications for the major cities, and lots of extrapolation. I'm sort of reminded a little bit after 9/11, there was a sense that nobody was going to move into high-rise office buildings again, but of course they did. If we look beyond the next 6 months, the next 3-4 years, how do you think office space evolves?
I wish I knew the answer to the question. What I probably can point to is in the Asia-Pac region, most people went back to their offices and reoccupied them quite quickly. And again, and this isn't just Savills, this is all of the various industries. They reoccupied, and across China, Hong Kong example, where many of the buildings are high-rise, we've seen a reoccupation going forward, the same across other markets. And the same is true actually in Europe, which is more of a direct comparison to the UK markets. People went back to the offices more quickly. Why is UK, or why London has been perhaps slightly behind that? It's perhaps the type of industry that's in some of these markets, whether it's financial, and a number of businesses have found that they can function pretty well, either working flexibly or remote. Hence, that's been the trend in parts of London. And the US has got the same rhetoric. Overall, I think the pendulum will swing back. Most of what we've seen now, 7 months through it, has been that the ability to maintain business is okay on a sort of flexible or remote working platform. The ability to actually grow business, create business, look at new opportunities, and the other points being mental health and mentoring of younger staff, those things are starting now to be seen very clearly in the stark reality that remote working can become very remote. And when we've done our surveys, we found that the majority of occupiers regard the office still as the best place to create, to collaborate. And most are saying somewhere between 3 and 4 days in an office is their preference, and not sort of 1 to 2. We will see demand return. Right now, I think what's happening is a lot of people are sitting on their hands. So, you know, the markets are impacted. Leasing volumes are significantly down, perhaps worldwide, anywhere between 30 and 40% down. So it's a very significant shock to the market.
I think that maybe there's a recognition as well that for corporations, large corporations, building and maintaining culture doesn't happen via Zoom calls.
I'm with you totally. Also, you've got to remember that home working, if your family want you back, that's fine. My family are very keen to see me packed off back to my office and they can have their home office back. I enjoy all the collaboration with colleagues and it's been great to be back in the office.
So let's talk a little bit about these overseas flows, because obviously over recent years, London particularly has seen tremendous inflows from Asia, but not just from Asia. I was in the city this morning. Of course, it feels like a ghost town right now. You've got a cheap pound. You've got these headwinds. How are foreign investors reconciling those two forces?
If there is a pent-up demand sign, my goodness, it's there. If money and people could travel more freely, it would be very significant. I mean, the beginning of the year, how fateful this was, I actually said publicly that I felt that London real estate, this is commercial offices, I felt that the capitalization rates, the yields that investors wanted, would probably compress sort of 4% or 3.5% prime yields. I was expecting them perhaps to fall some 25 to 50 basis points because I felt that the UK and London in particular was mispriced on the world stage. Perhaps that was a bit of a hangover from Brexit, all the discussions for a period of time, and obviously they're still going on. But we've seen that. So a number of investors held back from investing to the same degree in London whilst there was uncertainty. Continental Europe really saw that yield compression. And so cap rates were anything between 0.5% and 1% below prime rates in London. And that just felt wrong. Wrong for the quality of stock, wrong for the quality of the tenure that we can provide. Had we not had this pandemic, we would have seen an increased capital allocation into UK and into London. The dry powder that's available and the defensive qualities of real estate plus an income producing ability, I do see that that will be a strong resurgence as the markets reopen. Of course, people will be worried perhaps about the office demand element. They're going to be careful around that, probably aim towards the core, the prime end of the market. But I do see very significant Asian flows, particularly out of Hong Kong, out of some of the Singaporean markets, the Korean markets, and pan-European investors, because Brexit will have been finalized one way or the other by December. So we're already seeing quite good volumes in September onwards in London offices. You've seen all of those nationality investors starting to come back and look at prime grade A offices. So that's positive. Plus, we've got US investors looking at this, if you like, the changes in retail. And that's a contracyclical buy, I appreciate. But they're seeing value there too.
Yep. And let's not forget the gilt yields are on the floor and unlikely, particularly if we have suppression of long-term interest rates, to rise very much in the foreseeable future. So that yield gap has actually widened in favor of commercial property.
Absolutely. It is that defensive quality. And allocations have been historically lower for the liquidity purposes, as you well know. But I think the idea of increasing allocation has been something that's been occurring during the period. Equally, the ability to raise new equity for funds has been significant. And I can see that continuing as well for all the reasons you outlined.
But are the banks going to be more reluctant because of all of these things we've talked about to be providing debt finance as they used to?
They've not been the force for quite a number of years that they have been. They've been getting out of debt in that way. And so we've had an infill of debt funds and different vehicles to provide the facility in that gap. And again, there's an awful lot of equity in the market.
Let's talk about agricultural land here in the UK. I think I'm right in saying 70% of total land in the UK is agricultural. There's a sort of an emotional attachment to owning agricultural land, but there's an income and a tax advantage as well. But volumes are low, as I understand it. How should we think about agricultural land?
Well, very good question. Again, defensive quality. Land is in short supply in the UK, as it is in many other markets. In that box, agriculture, there's all sorts, from prime arable to forestry. And also, we are very keen on and develop a lot in energy, because the agricultural part of our business has the ability to create lots of green energy, obviously carbon offsetting and other things for the future needs. It's a very important area. A lot of global investors are more and more attracted to it, again, from an ESG credential as well. Carbon offsetting is definitely going to become something that is going to become more and more prominent in corporate thinking going forward. I think forestry has been returning around about a 9% return over the last 20 years because of all those appreciative qualities.
Yeah, we had Anthony Dalwood, CEO of Gresham, on the show. They're the largest forestry owner, I think, in the UK. You're right. I think the numbers were 9% over 20 years on forestry. But I'm also reminded Warren Buffett talks about markets short term, they're voting machines, long term, they're weighing machines. And this, what happens to agricultural land post Brexit, is, in my opinion, is quite a lot of noise. And if you were there advising long-term capital, am I right in saying that you would be pretty enthusiastic about acquiring some of the land in that area where there currently is the largest doubt?
Yeah, I would, but most definitely. And I think there is real opportunity now to scale investor holdings in it. It's an area, if you're looking at contracyclical areas and defensive quality areas, I would say that is one that you should definitely be looking at.
Right. I just like to talk about inflation for a minute or two. I find myself in the camp that believes inflation will come back and it will surprise people in many parts of the world by being stronger than is current consensus. If we get an inflation, how would allocators of capital to the property world be, how should they be thinking in terms of where they want to be?
It's a very good question when cost of debt and yields are so low, and I appreciate the issues around, are we in an artificial environment? I mean, property by itself, normally in periods of higher inflation, Simon, performs well, perhaps apart from the extreme levels of inflation, where obviously those really do impact on it. All areas of real estate, definitely inflation can be positive, whether it be inflation in rents, inflation in opportunities that can grow the confidence in the area. It can be regarded, except for the extreme level, as a very positive stimulator for further investment in the sector. How far it goes, and that the reverse yield gap that's attached to property is obviously significant at the moment. Obviously, as debt increases, debt starts to narrow. But on top of that, normally we end up with rental growth, which offsets it. So I think overall the seesaw is there. It's well established. And I would hope that property would remain attractive through that period.
And as you look across your geographies where you operate, are there some, and I know you've got a very big footprint in Asia, but are there some that particularly excite you from a returns standpoint?
In terms of the economies that maybe have benefited, definitely Vietnam, manufacturing, Indonesia, again, similarly. So those are showing really strong signs of recovery. Of course, Hong Kong and China, particularly mainland China, has picked up very significantly, and actually the economy is moving fast forward. We've seen improvement across Australia, and probably the most recent out of its lockdown is Singapore. And Singapore is well positioned for future growth. That will again continue in that region. So I would say that those markets, particularly the growth markets in Asia Pac, India, most definitely. India, I would say, is, despite obviously very concerning figures in terms of the pandemic currently, we're seeing corporate activity in India, a great labor force, a very educated labor force, and good value real estate. Across other markets, the European markets, you know, again, those markets which are less expensive but have good labor forces. I see Poland picking up, and the Czech Republic and CEE generally showing greater opportunities for growth too. I think the UK is actually very well positioned. you know, quite what our future relationship with the EU is, who knows? But we will see greater growth in the UK and greater inward investments, as I say. So there's a lot of factors at play, I would say. I wouldn't ignore the US. There are plenty of areas of the US, both in North America, Canada, and South America, where we're seeing that latent growth come through as well.
Moving from geographical exposures to sectoral, I've been intrigued talking to a couple of very successful serial investors who are looking to acquire leisure and entertainment and restaurant assets that they haven't seen at this level for 20 years. Prices have fallen a lot. What's your particular view there in terms of activity and interest?
Well, yeah, good point. And lowest volumes this year of any shopping center transactions ever probably underlines it. Hotels, definitely a very significant downturn, and the same in all forms of hospitality. So a lot of CVAs, a lot of businesses going bust, and in virtually every market, rental concessions having to be given to keep people going. Going back to the point about contracyclical, that is the sector with the greatest distress. But in some cases, take hotels, it also has some of the best real estate attached to it. Prime real estate in prime locations, in prime cities around the world. So I do see it coming back, and I do see the ability to invest in that in a contracyclical way already starting. We're seeing it in retail. American private equity is active in the retail sector. Inevitably, I would see it further into hospitality sectors going forward. I think there was a recent, in the media, it was talked about some of the recovery not being seen in the hotels markets until 2024. Human nature being as it is, when we emerge into a position where we can travel, I think we could see a resurgence much more quickly than that in terms of activity in the sector. And I think the investors can. So to me, there's a lot of people anticipating that stress, creating liquidity for them to buy in at distressed prices. So yeah, I think next year we'll see quite a bit of that.
I think there's maybe too much pessimism and the markets are beginning to look through some of that. Let's just talk about Savills specifically. You've been around since 1855. Well, I know you haven't been around since then, but the business has. And you have your tentacles sort of everywhere. You also interact with the city. And I just wonder, when you deal with the analyst community, how well you think they understand your business?
They're getting better. No, we're perhaps explaining it better. This is the truth. The bits that they need to understand around the componentry of our business. We're famous for residential. We're famous for different things in different parts of the world. And so it is a complex business to get to understand and for us as the management team to explain. I mean, the fact that almost 40% of what we do is property management, repeat income, which actually is very stable through ups and downs of the business cycle. So having that sort of defensive qualities in the business is really important. We're unashamedly multi-sector. So we do everything in real estate. And we like that. We like that diversity. We like the reuse of land. And it's important to make sure we continue that. The other thing around our strategy, Simon, is always to maintain, even through thick and thin, our bench strength. Not into is creating overcapacity and then cutting into undercapacity. Markets do return. Our clients need servicing more effectively in more difficult markets. And so if I take retail, which we've talked about earlier, we've maintained bench strength in retail because everybody's got a problem with retail. And therefore, as a service supplier, we've got to make sure we can provide solutions to them. So I think all of those pieces are messages we have to get out to our shareholders, to our analysts, and make sure that they understand how the business is constructed. But we like the diversity, sector and geography, very important to us.
And you've got £20 billion of assets under management as well. So you've been growing this discretionary pool. Is that because you'd like to take some of the cyclicality out of the business, or is it driven by something else?
It's a very important part of the business because the service lines that we provide, a lot of clients want to invest in different forms through an investment manager or a fund manager, a real estate fund manager. That has been a natural step for us to have that as part of our group activities. The way people access real estate investment, it's right to have that, to grow that platform. it's international capital as well. So our Savills investment management platform operates across Asia Pac, Europe, and the UK. And it's important that we can connect money with product across that. It's right to have it in the armory. And it's not about being averse to transactional markets. But if two-thirds of our business, which is approximately the case, is in more defensive quality, including investment management, that's a good sort of keel for the ship. That's what we like. We like to have the balance. And of course, the fact that transactional markets will come back and are high margin when they do come back, we're not pulling out of transactional markets.
And how would you, at the end of your tenure, like to be judged?
Positively. I think what I would like to have done over my tenure, wherever that may end, and I hope not too soon, would be around accelerated growth in the Asia-Pac region, which, as you heard, I'm a fan of, continued growth across the European business, and also more sector diversification across our North American platform, where primarily what we do is in the office sector. So again, logistics and many other sectors, we're growing fast there. Most importantly, though, it's about maintaining the culture, Simon. I think because we haven't been road warriors doing lots and lots of large-scale M&A, Savills, thanks to all that history you mentioned, its legacy must be to maintain its DNA. And it's about, the DNA is about service. It's about really high-quality service to our clients and a rewarding place to work. If I hand the baton over, I would like to make sure we've grown, but we've also perhaps unified, even to even greater degree, that we're working collaboratively across all those markets, but also be aware of the change that's going to come.
So on a more general note, a lot of young people listening to this show, for which we're very grateful, and we've had nearly all of our speakers offer career advice. Young people thinking about getting into the world of real estate, what would you suggest?
It's a great place to work. I genuinely do. Dare I say it, we have a great deal of fun and variety in real estate. Because it's a physical product, Simon, we're always out looking at things. It evolves. Every site becomes something else in the future. That appeal is very high. And the fact that it's such an international market, real estate is great fun. It really is. I think for me, the reason why I love it so much is the people. They're really interesting people in real estate.
I know you support many charities and you're a big supporter of cancer research and Land Aid, but Land Aid was new to me. Just tell me a little bit about that, please.
That's about providing shelter for homeless young people. It's a major problem, particularly in our city centres, and the lack of provision. So Land Aid is a terrific charity and looking to provide that and has done fantastic work. And even so, even through the pandemic, you can imagine not being able to shelter during the period because of homelessness. You can understand the pressing need to support charities like this that look after people in a difficult time. It's been a real estate charity for many years, because if we can't unlock opportunity to shelter people in real estate, then we're not doing our job.
I know you're seated in the West End, but I gather you're a very keen scuba diver and mariner. And I wonder whether you'd had any particularly notable exploits or scary moments on your various nautical travels.
I have. Too many. My wife would tell you too many to talk about. I probably would just highlight one, where I was taking a boat, actually a sailing yacht, back from the Hamble on the south coast with some of my closest friends, by the way. And we were going up to Anglesey, where I was going to keep this boat. Needless to say, the forecast was somewhat wrong. I don't blame it being myself getting it wrong. And we ended up in a force 9, which then hit force 10 in the Irish Sea. During that storm, we actually rolled. The boat, the yacht rolled and then came back upright. And I had a number of crew over the side on harnesses. We got them all back in. The boat was still safe. It took us 9 hours to get out of the storm and got into Wicklow in the Southern Ireland to shelter. Two things that it taught me. And that's, if things really get tough, you just got to keep going. I had a great sense of responsibility, my friends, all of whom had children. So it was getting through it. Props on a more lighter-hearted note, one of the sails that you're meant to deploy in such a storm is a storm jib. And one of my crew, during the middle of the storm, before we rolled, said, "Mark, where's the storm jib?" And I said, "China," because it hadn't arrived and it was still in a bag in China. Didn't help us during the period. that was perhaps the scariest moment. I don't intend to go through it again if I can help it. And I'm sure the friends on board at the time don't want to go through it again either.
And post this COVID, if you can take a family holiday, where would you like to go?
Oh, I'd love to go to either the Greek islands, which I love, Simon, for their tranquility and beauty. And one of my favourite pastimes, when I'm allowed to, is to sail around the islands because they are stunning and unspoilt. So that would be one. Going back to my interest in scuba diving, I also love the Maldives. If I were able to go out to the Maldives again one day in the future, I know there's a channel opening up as we speak, but I'm not, unfortunately, I've got quite a lot of work to do. But in the future, I would love to go back out to the Maldives and do some scuba diving. So those would be my two first choices.
Well, Mark, it's been a fantastically interesting conversation. I'm going to finish with one question, which is piggybacking off this book I mentioned on another show. But if you could tell me just one thing.
If I could tell you just one thing, it would be to use your ears and not your mouth. Your mouth gets you in trouble, but your ears never does.
That could be beautifully aimed at me, Mark. That's very good, and I don't know you.
Certainly not, Simon.
Mark, it's been a terrific conversation. I think I'm going to take away that there's a lot of firepower on the sidelines to be deployed in real estate in a number of parts of the world, which I think makes a very interesting, you know, line of thinking for investors, and that specifically, you know, those Asian countries, you mentioned Vietnam, Indonesia, Singapore, and India, have themselves some specific characteristics that make them quite exciting. There's lots of reasons for us to recognize this is difficult times, but, you know, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about returns as well as we look out beyond the horizon. So, Mark, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.